I'd like to refer to just about five or six items that I think Christians need to take seriously with respect to Marx. And in the course of doing that, I'll try to relate them to the items that that I picked up from Marx yesterday that I thought were significant, and hopefully tie them together in that way, identifying the Marxian concepts that I think are useful or challenging for Christians. The first one that I pick up on is that I think there's a significance of Marx with respect to the doctrine of creation. Remember Marx's notion of praxis, that praxis for Marx is this concept that human beings are the creators of the world of value. And that's, of course, rooted in his notion of the labor theory of value. Well, if those things hold conceptually for us, then I believe we'll have to do some serious rethinking of our doctrine of creation. I'd like to suggest a possible resource for doing that thinking, and if any of you are interested, you can go pick up a tape out of the tape library. A week ago, I did a presentation on, I guess it's 2 weeks ago now almost, I did a presentation on Luther's doctrine of creation, in which I tried to point out that for Luther, creation is fundamentally a present event that takes place under the word, the commanding word of God, but happens through created agencies, including, maybe most especially for Luther, including human agencies. In other words, what I'm saying is that Luther's doctrine of creation itself is oriented towards sociology rather than some kind of natural theology or natural science orientation, for starters. You can just think about the explanation of the first article of the Creed and the Catechism to come up with that. To say that God is creator means the giving and preservation of body and soul, limbs and senses, and all I need from day to day. And you know that the all I need from day to day includes things like good government, food, shelter, clothing, good reputation, and all the rest. So Luther has that doctrine that's sort of sociologically oriented. And I'd like to suggest that that it's possible that Lutherans taking the doctrine of creation seriously would have Marx as a natural conversational partner far beyond most of the philosophical or religious or natural philosophies and opinions than with which it's usually been allied. So that's one item, significance in the doctrine of creation stemming from Marx's concept of praxis and the labor theory of value. The second one that I pick up on is Marx's commitment to analyze systems and their determining impact on human life and behavior. It seems to me that that opens up all kinds of possibilities for Christians to understand the biblical witness about principalities and powers and demons and transpersonal forces of evil. Any acquaintance with the history of biblical scholarship will let you know that what scholarship, what rationalized, scientific, so-called historical critical scholarship has done with the New Testament has been to say, when you come across this framework of talk, like in Paul, where we don't battle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, and all of the witness in those writings about Christ disarming the principalities and powers and so on, the tendency has been to say, well, you know, that's the mythological packaging that the gospel was put in the first century, but now we know better than that, and so we kind of demythologize it and we put it into some kind of new framework for understanding. Well, I'd like to suggest that Marx's intention and his understanding to say, let's pay attention, folks, to the fact that what really determine our personal lives are transpersonal forces manifest in institutions, that opens up a way for us to understand that New Testament talk as something more than the quaint packaging of the biblical message. Not unrelated to that, the third item that I pick up on is Marx's thoroughgoing anti-reformism. Remember that for Marx, systems are replaced, not reformed. To put it as crudely as possible, Marx does not think you can make capitalism better. It can only go by the boards and be replaced by another system, a system that operates on a totally different logic, a different coherence mechanism, if you will. I think that has a lot to say by way of opening up Lutheran catechetical teaching with respect to baptism. You may remember that in the catechism, the old Adam is dealt with not by reform, but by death and resurrection. Now, the good news for the old Adam is you're going to die. That's the gospel with respect to the old Adam. The old Adam dies. Luther is at that point a thoroughgoing anti-reformist. But now, what is the old Adam? Okay. The old Adam is not some individual located at the past beginning of history, but the old Adam is precisely the corporate humanity organized around egocentricity and greed, i.e. sin, and the way in which the old Adam manifests itself in each one of us. Okay? And that can't be reformed. That has to be put to death so that the new person in Christ arises. I think that would be a terrific point of conversation, the anti-reformist point, between at least Lutheran Christians, I would assume all Christians would get in on that, and their Marxist conversational partners. Okay. Fourth item, Marx's concept of alienation as being something objective and not just simply human psychological feeling. I think that could help us in our talk about sin and guilt. I may be really off the wall at this point, but I think that the psychological and therapeutic society in which we live has just about succeeded in reducing all of life to mood, to how we feel about it. And the net effect of that is that it's almost impossible to have any kind of serious moral or ethical discourse. I think that Marx has a larger vision than that and a critique of human life in the world that is more objective, and therefore he might be able to help us talk about ethics beyond feelings again, and I would count that as a significant contribution. Fifth, I think that for all of our talk in this society about community and intimacy, we're in fact not very good at it, and that our world is still a depersonalized and depersonalizing world. And I think that perhaps Marx's notion of life being reduced to commodity would be a helpful analytical tool for understanding what's going on here. I guess I mean something like this. Remember that for Marx, what happens under the impact of initially the introduction of money as the commodity of commodities, and therefore the arbiter of all value in the world, that human life and labor have itself become simply commodities, packaged for sale and exchange in some way or another. But if you know the story of the little prince, as the fox observed to the little prince, there are no shops where you can buy friendship. Okay. But what has happened in our society? Right? The accoutrements, the externalities of friendship have in fact become marketable. From Dale Carnegie courses, through a variety of effectiveness courses and classes and counselings, all of that kind of stuff. On Main Street, Barstow Street in Eau Claire, okay? Across the street from the movie theater, there's the Bible Nook and Cosmetic Shop, you know? And I think that's a kind of paradigm almost of modern society, whether it's the gospel or appearance or love or intimacy or whatever, it has now become a marketable product and we can sell it some way or another. And I think that if we look at that under Marx's notion of commodities as being the breakdown of value and life, we have to raise the question, is all of that packaging and marketing of stuff cure or another symptom of the disease? Serious question for me there. But perhaps most of all, and this will be my last comment, and then the conversation I hope can follow, I think above all, Marx's method is more important than his results in any detailed way. I think if somebody came along tomorrow and was able to demonstrate empirically that all of the results of Marx's analysis were wrong, very frankly, I don't expect that to happen, but even if it happened, more important than any of the detail of those results, the real significant item would be that Marx gave a method to people to look at the world. And what he essentially did was to say, I want to encourage you to find reality by looking not at theories prepared in abstract and purportedly outside of human relationships, but to look at the actual human history and society in its working, and there find out what is going on in the human enterprise. I think that ought to have some inherent attraction to biblical people, to people of biblical faith. A story that I hope can make the point reasonably clear as to what I'm driving at. William Stringfellow, an attorney and lecturer and sometimes a theological thinker, reports a story that goes like this. He was lecturing at a seminary someplace, and he made some comment in the course of his lecture that got the seminary president all riled up about things. And the seminary president came up to him after the lecture and said to him, "No responsible theologian would say what you just said." And Stringfellow was sort of taken back and nonplussed and a little bit hurt by that comment. As the post-speech conversation went on, somebody in the audience came up to him and said that he might find some comfort in the fact that Kierkegaard had said essentially the same thing 120 years before Stringfellow had said it. And so, with great delight over lunch, Stringfellow reported to the seminary president the source of his idea in Kierkegaard. And the president's response was, "Well, Kierkegaard is not a responsible theologian." And Stringfellow's editorial comment on that was this: of course Kierkegaard was not a responsible theologian. He only lived in the world where God lives, not in the seminaries where the professors live. Okay? That I think, is very closely connected. That story very closely connected with what Marx really asks of us, and that is, drop your theories and pay attention to the world. And I say that ought to have some attraction to biblical people, because while the biblical witness asserts a lot of things about God, the most common thing and the underlying thing that the biblical witness asserts about God is that God is active to create and redeem life in the real down-to-earth world of history in which human beings live. And that's a hidden activity, to be sure, but biblically speaking, a hidden activity is not an invisible activity. Huh? It's hidden under the cross, focally, for biblical people. Hidden under the cross. The cross is there for all to see. It's the humanity of God. It's the humanity of God at work to create and restore his creation. And yet, at the same time, you know, faith only sees that. I understand that full well. But the cross itself asks us to pay attention to the real world as the locus of God's activity. And I think that in some ways, Marx's very down-to-earth and empirical evaluation of things and analysis of things really says to biblical people, put up or shut up. Now, either be able to talk coherently about the work of God in the world, or don't talk. But whatever you do, don't theorize. Don't make your religious talk the result of some kind of speculation about things in the great beyond, or something like that. I think that's a challenge that biblical people ought to want to take up, given the nature of biblical faith. Well, in any event, those are my six items, and my intention is to stop at that point and use the rest of the time for conversation.
Somewhere I have some vague indication that there are some conversations taking place between Christians and people of Marxist philosophy, but I don't know where or what the nature of those are. Are you?
Let me identify several for you. One of those is the most obvious conversation that's taking place in places where both Christians and Marxists are actually engaged in revolutionary struggles of some kind or another. The dominant one of those, it seems to me, is in Central and South America, where because of the Roman Catholic Christian influence there, a style of theology that you probably at least all have heard of called liberation theology has developed. And liberation theology is a very conscious effort to work between biblical faith and Marxist analysis. So that's one critical place where the conversation takes place. Another place where it takes place is in Eastern Europe, where Christians have been just simply by force of circumstances thrust into conversation with Marxist regimes at that point. That's radically different, huh? Because in the revolutionary situation in Latin and Central America, neither the Christians or the Marxists are in power, and that gives one shape, a cooperative shape, to the dialogue. In Eastern Europe, it's Marxist-Leninist regimes that are in power, and Christians are out of power, and that gives a radically different shape to it. That's been mostly the struggle of Christians to say, how can we live as Christians in officially Marxist-Leninist societies? A footnote to that is that that dialogue probably had its most fruitful period in the middle 60s, in Czechoslovakia. It was a fundamental part of that movement in Czechoslovakian Marxism that came to be called Marxism with a Human Face and was so vigorously put down by the Soviet regime. So much for full democratic life under Leninism. Huh? That conversation was a very fruitful conversation. North Americans can get in on the result of that through a number of books that have been published in this country, I think all by Fortress Press, the LCA house organ, you know. They published some of the results of that Christian Marxist dialogue in Czechoslovakia in book form. I'm not real good at the names in that at this stage of the game, but I know one of the books is titled A Marxist Looks at Jesus, which was a kind of presentation on Jesus by one of the Marxist philosophers on the university faculty where this was located in Prague. And then there's another one on Marx by one of the Christian participants in that. That name I can identify, Jan Milek Lochman, and several other documents. So that's available. You can participate in that if you want to read on that story by just picking up that material. The third place of dialogue that I think can be pointed to is in some ways derivative of that, but the Lutheran World Federation has had an ongoing Christian Marxist dialogue study project that has produced a lot of material, and probably derivative of that, they also have had a long-standing, I'd say it's at least 10 years old, China study project, where there's a lot of material out on the relationship between Christians and the so-called New China. Recent developments seem to indicate that the New China has retreated to something, either a newer China or a less than new China, depending on where you're coming from. But that documentation can all be gotten simply by writing to Lutheran World Ministries in New York. And so there's a lot of resource on that subset. Lutheran World Ministries, to relate to that, has had a Marxism study project going for the last 5 years. That not quite culminated, but at least led to a Christian Marxist dialogue conference at the end of April in Illinois, which I had a chance to participate in, and discovered there that within the next 2 years, Lutheran World Ministries, as a result of that study project, is planning on having published a book that's essentially designed as congregational study resource on the issue. So those are at least some places where the dialogue has manifested itself pretty concretely up to now.
Good. Well, your last comment anticipated what my question was. We have an active adult forum in our congregation, and the person who happens at this point in time to have leadership there is one who would find it absolutely anathema to try to think that there is such a thing as conversation mm-hmm. taking place between Marxists, philosophers, and Christians. And I was just wondering what other resources would be appropriate for something. Study guides are sort of long haul. Is there yeah. anything that is available, program material that you could tapes, slides, show anything that is like a half hour followed by something like this?
The one thing that I can think of, I don't know how readily available it is, but that you could at least inquire about. In, let's see, this is 83, last year was 83. In 1981, Lutheran World Ministries sponsored a trip, a six-week summer trip to East Germany for college students. And those people were, of course, accompanied by, some sort of pastoral staff who were supposed to, one, provide some guidance for them, but also to make connections. I have seen a slide presentation about Christian life in Marxist-Leninist East Germany that's a result of that trip. That would be a kind of good introduction because, one, it's pictorial, two, it's not very technical or anything like that, but demonstrates what's going on in the relationship between church and a officially Marxist society, at least in one place. And that might be available from LWM.
I was wondering, is there, it was about 10, 15 years ago, we had a lot of publicity or propaganda, whatever you want to call it, about only the elderly went to Christian churches in Russia, say. Mm-hmm. And is there any evidence that the youth are starting to pick it up or anything, or is it still...
I think that there's two things that really have to be dealt with. One is the official Soviet propaganda has a very vested interest in trying to make it clear that only the old people go to church, because they really want to imply that Christian faith is a dying operation. That, in other words, that really the only people who still cling to this are the few pre-revolutionaries who are left. Well, that obviously becomes increasingly implausible as time goes on. I mean, how many people are there who are still around, who were there before the revolution? You know, that becomes an increasingly farther back point of history. That's one item. It seems to me that there are certain elements also in American society that have a vested interest in not accurately portraying the church situation in the Soviet Union. Probably the most notorious of them, you know, the variety of Bible smuggler groups like the Slavic Gospel Association and so on, who go out and make pitches among the churches, you know, to raise funds to smuggle Bibles into the Soviet Union. Well, I objectively don't know the situation within the Soviet Union, although about 2 years ago there was a couple of good pieces in Sojourner's magazine that portrayed a much more significant religious life in the Soviet Union than either side would be inclined to lead you to believe, within the framework of the Orthodox Church. And the Bible smuggler routine, of course, is always that there are these small fundamentalist groups who are thriving in the struggle and so on and so forth, but that the main church is corrupt. Well, the Sojourner's magazine tends to portray that differently. But I'll tell you a much more fun story, I think, as far as, and some of you may be aware of this. During the course of the 17th century, there were some significant migrations of Germans into Russian territory, particularly the so-called Volga Germans, okay, because they settled in the Volga Valley region. These were people were all Lutherans, and they practiced their Lutheran faith inside Tsarist Russia, and did so after the revolution. In 1939, when war was declared between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, the Volga Germans were looked upon as a kind of potential fifth column, you know, subversive group, and so the Stalinist regime just simply deported all of these folks to Siberia. And Lutheran channels throughout the world just lost track of them. Nobody knew what had happened to them, where they were, whether they still were, or anything. In sometime around the turn of the year from 1976 to 77, I'm not real sure of the dating, my encounter with it was in about late April or early May of 1977, when I was in New York at the time, just happened to be in the Lutheran World Ministry office when this took place. I was kind of dumb luck, like most of the rest of my life, I suppose. But in any event, around the turn of the year, Paul Hansen, German churchman who was the secretary for Europe for Lutheran World Federation at the time, got a message from the Officer of Religious Affairs for the Soviet Union saying, hey, we've discovered that we've got like 200,000 German Lutherans scattered in some cities in southern lower Siberia, Kazakhstan, and those kinds of places. If you look on a map, one of the central cities is Alma-Ata. If you can find a map of the Soviet Union for some kind of location and then sort of spread out in circles from there. And we've discovered that they're there. We don't really know what to do with them. They've been out of touch with any of the other Lutheran bodies for years, and we wonder if you would like to come in to pay them a fraternal visit. So Paul Hansen, of course, said sure, and he and a couple other people came in, were duly escorted to that place by the Soviet government, put in contact with these Lutheran folks. He showed some slides of it. Now, I mean, those slides that I saw of Lutherans in Siberia, apart from the costume differences, age-wise, could have been any congregation that I know in the United States. Okay? Intriguingly enough, they had survived, right, from 1939 until 1977 with no trained clergy, with only the most outdated catechisms and worship materials. They had, lay people who would mostly, for Sunday morning worship, read, old Luther sermons or something like that that they had managed to bring along with them. And the Soviet government made arrangements for these people to send their designated folks from their number to the Lutheran seminary in Riga in Latvia so that they could pick up theological training and come back. Made arrangements. They said, what is it that you really want? And they said, we really want Bibles and catechisms and worship materials. Soviet government made arrangements with Lutheran World Federation to provide Bibles in German, worship materials, catechism, German for all of these folks. They're still there. They're going on and so on and so forth. They meet in large houses. They don't have any kind of church buildings, but they meet in large houses. And I understand there are a lot of specific restrictions on the building of churches. And you have to be licensed to meet by the Soviet. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I don't want to turn the Soviet Union into a Christian government or something like that. That's not the point. The point is that that there's some very cooperative things that were done by the Soviet government, Lutheran World Federation. The Soviet government asks on this a couple of things. They say, one, it's not good for our reputation throughout the world if you make this too well known. Okay, so we would appreciate it if you would just simply do it and not make a lot of hay out of it. Secondly, Paul Hansen said, the guy deliberately said to him, we are willing to work with you because we know that you will not try to smuggle political tracts in the Bibles. You know, you'll send Bibles as such and not try to stick anti-Soviet tracts in them for people to read. And the last comment, and then that's the end of the story, is a guy said to Paul Hansen, how are you doing in the rest of the Eastern Bloc states? And Hansen's response was at the time, well, we're doing pretty good except in East Germany. Except in East Germany. And then this guy's response was, well, I guess we'll have to lean on comrade, whatever his name is, a little bit. Now, I observed that was in end of April, beginning of May, maybe mid-May at the latest of 77. I observe that in October, Reformation Day, I think, of 1977, was the first big public Lutheran gathering in East Germany in years, 25,000 people in an outdoor arena in Leipzig for Reformation celebrations. So apparently, comrade whatever his face has got leaned on from Moscow. So, it's a kind of mixed story. I don't think we should be optimistic. The Soviet Union would prefer everybody to be officially atheist and so on. But in fact, as early as the 1920s, officially, the Soviet Union redefined Christianity over against other religions. There's official documentation of that. I have a great source for this. My oldest daughter did a little, research paper on religion in the Soviet Union when she was in about eighth grade, and managed to uncover all this kind of neat stuff for me, that Soviet government actually officially redefined Christianity around 1927, 1928, someplace in there. so that it's a different status than all other religions in terms of the official understanding of things, because they wanted to recognize the progressive contributions of Christianity to, you know, human evolution, or whatever the right word is in that.
As well as the Catholic Church, evangelicals are hard at work in Latin America too, and they have a sort of a different tension. Sure. They have not probably been quite as closely associated with the revolution, I don't believe. Do you have any comments or insights as to how that is going?
As far as I can tell, there's a kind of split on that. And evangelical is a sort of a catchy word at that point. There are some extremely conservative right-wing evangelistical, if you will, church groups centered in North America that have a kind of basic, part of their doctrinal system is an anti-communism. And so that ideological framework makes them non-cooperative and subject to all other things. But the Protestant and evangelical minorities in Latin and Central America, or South and Central America, have had variety of circumstances. Intriguingly enough, in Chile, I think Chile and Argentina both, Pentecostal churches have been very vital and very progressive at the same time, have not been simply right-wing government supporters. I don't know the story on that in Central America at all. Just no position to comment.
Yesterday you said that Marx was raised as a German intellectual.
Yeah.
When do you think that started? Was it in his late teens, early 20s, or when he started?
Well, he wrote a very fascinating treatise on graduating from high school and the Gospel According to John, like I mentioned. So I think it stayed through then. I'll give you an intriguing story, and I'll give you a footnote for it, too. There's a book entitled Marx Against the Marxists by Jose Miranda, who's a Mexican Roman Catholic liberation theologian. The fundamental contention of that book, as you can tell from the title, is that that current-day Marxisms are not the perpetuation of Marx at all, but are contradictory to it, and that Marx ought to be hauled out in opposition to that. Miranda goes almost so far as to try to make Marx himself a kind of closet Christian. Okay, I'm not sure that's fair from what I can tell. But there's an intriguing story that he records in this book that I assume is accurate, and if it is accurate, I think speaks reams. He records a story out of the papers, the autobiographical papers of Marx's daughter. Okay? Marx's daughter, who was a Christian, about Marx's instruction of her and her brothers and sisters in the Bible as children, okay? And she talks about how, never having heard the story about how the rich conspired to crucify Jesus, told in more inspiring ways than told to her by her father. And as soon as I say, and I wanted to be honest about that, all right, and say how the rich conspired to crucify Jesus, all right? So that you get the fact that there's a kind of ideological thrust in this, but there's at least some kind of evidence that that while Marx was never a practicing church person as an adult, as we would kind of define that, that maybe he never quite shucked all of his biblical baggage. You know, well, that's not my effort to redeem Marx. I think Marx should be allowed to be whatever he wants to be, and I don't want to, you know. I mean, he was baptized once, and that's sufficient. He doesn't need me to redo it in some kind of ideological way. But I don't know much of that history. Of course, I suspect that his own involvement was probably pretty much like the normal high school and early college youth involvement in Germany in the 18th century. I mean, to try to even superimpose American 20th century denominational patterns of church life, even on 20th century Germany, much less 19th century Germany, I mean, there's no way you can understand anything in that framework. We had an exchange student at Eau Claire this year that I used as a German tutor for myself. And I mean, this young woman, she counts herself as a good, faithful, evangelical Christian, but it boggles her mind to look at the American scene. She's from Northern Germany. It boggles her mind to look at the American scene and think that there are people who actually go to worship every Sunday. I mean, that, you know, she counts herself a good, faithful, evangelical Christian, but weekly worship attendance just is not part of that package for her. That's a mind. I mean, she just would talk in amazement about the fact that people would understand that in that way. And I suspect that, you know, that it was probably like that and then some in the 19th century, and that as a youth, that determined Marx's, you know, own religious practice, and I'm sure that he got out of that. His official espousings of atheism are, in my estimation, as far as I can read the documents, not the result of theoretical religious speculation, but are the result of this fundamental notion of praxis that I tried to point to, and the labor theory of value. So he sees, Marx rejects God because he sees the notion of an almighty creator God as being stifling and deadening of human creativity. So it's a practical result for him. Okay. And his opposition to the churches was obviously rooted in his empirical understanding of what the churches in fact did in the Europe of his day. You all should feel free to vote with your feet and leave anytime, but also to stay, please.
I'd like to hear you comment some more about this notion that you were mentioning right at the end about principalities of power and things being extra-personal powers, because that, as a you know, as an empirical observation, things like could be used to explain things like the rise of Nazism and things like that, where once something is systematized, it has power beyond what any individual within that system would ever. Mm-hmm. Willingly give up to it. Right. Do you think that was?
I'm convinced that that all of us are very familiar, existentially familiar, with what the Bible calls principalities and powers and rulers and heavenly places and all of that. The modern equivalent terminology for that would be things like institution, corporation, role, ideology, and so on and so forth. Those kinds of things. Those very real but abstract items that all of us live in terms of. And I'll give you what I consider to be at least a kind of clear example of what happens in that. out of the fairly recent American experience. Remember, during the course of the 1972 presidential election campaign, what the group of people that pressed for Richard Nixon's reelection was called? The Committee to Reelect the President. Right. Now, presidents are not elected. Somebody is elected to the presidency. It was a committee to reelect Richard Nixon, who is a person to an office, the presidency. But what had happened during that course of time, and I would argue it happened, back when Richard Nixon was dealing with Alger Hiss, whenever that was, at around 1950 or so, that by that time the office, the role of president, had so come to dominate the person Richard Nixon that all of his decision making was always made in terms of that office. No more human decisions. Okay? And that at that point he had become so identified with the presidency that that's what called the shot. So we had a committee to reelect the president. That's the serious sort of tragic side with that kind of confusion. The humorous side was the televised birthday party during Nixon's thing, right, where everybody sang, "Happy birthday, Mr. President." Okay? Now his parents didn't even have a child anymore. They had an office. My sense of having been in the delivery room with my wife is that it's hard enough work giving birth to a child without having give birth to a presidency, or something like that. But see, what happens is then at that place, the role, the office president, takes over the human being and it calls the shots. That's very real for me. It would be not difficult at all for me to live out my whole life never as Lou Smith, a human being, making decisions and dealing with other human beings, but simply as the role of pastor, with all of the things that that requires. Pastor, too, is a demon. Yeah. Pastor, too, is a demon. It can take possession of the human being. It requires all the decisions to be made. Another example of that in my mind would be the whole very tragic incident around the marketing of the Pinto a few years back with Ford Motor Company. The evidence is quite clear that the people in that bureaucracy knew before the car went on the road that it was a bomb on wheels, that it was unbelievably dangerous. And yet the decision was made to go ahead with the marketing by the collective institutional logic that in terms of the profits, it was better to go ahead and let the insurance pay off the damages that would accrue than it was to retool and reorganize whatever had to be done, redesign on the assembly line to make this particular vehicle safe. It was the institution in its logic that made the decision. The mouthpiece for all of those decisions are specific human folks, but all that means is that they were possessed by that principality on it. And I think that that's what Marx's analysis of systems is really all about in the final analysis, is say that these things, these collectivities, they have the impact on human life. They become the shot callers. And we don't really do that anymore.
That also is one of the things about if you talk about replacing one system with another system, it is another principle.
That's right. That's right. I would say something like this. I don't think that the principalities, of course, are rooted in God. God created the principalities, created them, if you think about it, as mechanisms for mutual human service. See, I could, if my humanity remains lord over the principalities, I could use the office of pastor as a way of serving human folks. Other human beings, serving other human life. Okay. But what happens under the impact of what Christians have called the sin, called sin and the fall, and what Marx would describe as alienation of labor, I think, that what happens is that that all becomes twisted. And now the principalities make the decisions. It has to do with the same, it has to do with Genesis chapter 3, you know. The problem is not that there is a snake. The problem is that human beings let the snake make decisions for them. But in the creation story, human beings were given by God the task of making decisions about the snakes. And so it's that inversion that's the issue. Now, I would agree with you that that one ought not to be naive, and if we need anything to destroy our naivete, all we need to do is to look at the history of the Leninist systems that call themselves socialism, but have raised up the worst bureaucratic elites against working folks, you know? I mean, they even have the capacity to make some capitalists look good, you know.
When you were talking about the president, I kept thinking about the Pope. I've heard so many things, you know, that this Pope is more human than previous popes, and they even go back to his background, where he was born.
There's in some ways, I mean, I think that's a terrific example, both pro and con. There are a lot of ways in which this particular pope has used that office for really good, humane purposes. And there are a lot of other ways in which it's clear that that office still calls the shots for him, and he becomes personally immobilized by it. You know, so I mean, it's both a pro and con thing with him. Well, I would say something like, I mean, I would define liberation theology, as I observe it, as the attempt to bring together the biblical witness with Marx's analytical categories. Okay, and that it seems to me there are all kinds of liberation theologies, and no two of them are identical. But if you say what's at the root of it, one is that they really attempt to take the biblical witness seriously. And secondly, to use Marx's analytical categories as a way of understanding the situation in which they live. That's what sort of defines it for me. I don't know what else to say beyond that, unless, I mean, if you want to raise a specific question about something. I should say, for what it's worth on that score, I haven't really spun this out, but I'm really a hardcore Lutheran theologically. I really am. And I think that Roman Catholic theology, as the base of virtually all liberation theologies yet, they're still really done by Roman Catholic theologians, manifests itself as a failure at two particular points. One is they have a terribly difficult time still avoiding works righteousness, so that liberation becomes the result of human activities in that. That lends itself to some degree to Marx, but I think we need to remember that, you know, a very interesting observation at this point. I mean, when Marx spoke to workers in the 19th century, right? I mean, he did not say, let us all get our act together and make ourselves free. What he said was something like this, that Something is happening objectively in history. History itself is going someplace, and where it's going is to the classless society that includes your freedom. Okay. I mean, he did it as that kind of a statement. When he did that, the laboring people were enormously energized. Okay. And there were all kinds of revolutionary activity all over that finally came to fruition in some way, shape, or form in the Bolshevik Revolution, Soviet Union. As soon as they assumed power, the Bolsheviks became very uneasy about any kind of notion that let people think that history was going someplace without their being the agents of that history. And so they backed off that fundamental Marxist commitment and said, you know, well, of course history's going someplace if you do it. If you do it. Right? And the net result of that has been the stifling and the bureaucratization of human history. Now that ought to, I mean, Lutherans ought to really resonate to that. I mean, because Lutherans have always said, if you want to energize constructive and productive and loving and caring human life together, you don't lay a law trip on people telling them you got to do this. If you don't do this, nothing will happen. If you don't do it, God won't love you or any of that kind of stuff. What you do is you announce an unconditional promise. Hey, all of you folks out there who count yourself as unlovely and unloving and all that kind of stuff, God, for Christ's sake, loves you anyway. And Lutherans have said, and I think discovered for themselves, that that's an energizing kind of thing to do, and that the law ends up stifling human activity. So that's one point where I think that Lutherans could, as Christians, and at the same time having some things to say to Marxist folks, could get in on the liberation theology debate very constructively. That one point, how do you keep the gospel from becoming a new law? We should have some sympathy with that. The other thing is that Lutheran understanding about the twofold realm of God and rule of God, not realm, that's the wrong word, cancel that, wipe that off the tape. There are not two realms. There's the fact that Lutherans have understood that God rules the world in a twofold way. You know, one through civil orders, whatever that may be. That doesn't necessarily mean only government for Lutherans. It can mean also, I think, for example, the peace movement can be understood as political activity through which God confronts people to move to a more healthy way of living together, or something like that. Right? In other words, what I'm saying is that Lutherans ought to be able to say, we don't have to make closet Christians out of all liberationists. Liberation can stand as itself, as the work of God, and doesn't need to be toned up with Christian piety to make it go. If we did that, then, on the one hand, Christians could move into that simply as human beings and work humanly in that circumstance. And on the other hand, be able to say, now that we are here working humanly, what is the peculiar Christian thing to do? I think that what happens in what Lutherans have always referred to as the confusion of the two rules of God is that where that distinction is not made, Christians lose their peculiar witness and they become just what everybody else is doing. You know? So we could ask the question, on the one hand, if Christians as human beings can just simply undertake the liberating task with whoever happens to be along, and we understand that God works there, they don't have to be believers, then we can say, now, at the same time, what is it that we as believers might specifically contribute to this situation in which we find ourselves? I don't have an answer for that. But I think that style of thinking could be useful as a Lutheran contribution to the liberation theology thing.